Yesterday we completed frequent bumper, starting after the particle. Now, today we'd like to compute a forward function. And I seem to have forgotten the first page of my notes. So, I would like to compute the amplitude for two cations, two scattering to two cations. So as I mentioned yesterday, because each steady state carries a cyclos, and we have now four cyclos on a sphere, we need to understand, we need to put a B cost as well. This kind of makes sense because the modulus space of a sphere with four points is one-dimensional. Because we have the position of four points, but we only have three globally. Transformations to move points available to move points around. So I have one complex is a trivial dimensional model space. Now you could perhaps get confused by the fact that I should really be talking about model spaces of matrix, like on a certain surface. And so what I'm really talking about is modulus spaces of matrix on a surface looks like this, modulo Y transformations. Okay. When I'm looking at matrix which roughly becomes constant. But by the way, perhaps and modulo isomorphisms which also become constant. Far away on the cylinder. But once you map on a sphere, it becomes matrix which are smooth on the sphere, and modulo diffeomorphisms which do not move these points. Because the constant diffeomorphism here becomes something like a scalar transformation or a rotation of a point. And diffeomorphisms which, the diffeomorphisms that will move the point, becomes something that will blow up here. That's why this modulus space becomes the modulus space of a sphere with four points, where the position of the points matter. Now I need to pick a coordinate system on the sphere. I can do it in a variety of ways. So there's still a certain gauge freedom in picking a coordinate system on the sphere. Say I could say I pick a coordinate system where this is at zero, this is at one, this is at infinity, but I'm still left with the position of this point in the coordinate system. Now, to do things really in a honest way, I should introduce the B insertion in the way that we discussed. During the lectures. Where mu is a coordinate over my sphere. So I should consider something like this. And I should also put an insertion. Let me put the mu outside. This is an integral over the surface of this object. And then there is another integral over the surface of the bar derivative. OK, so this is the most general expression I could write. OK, makes sense. There are three C smaller than B's. It is invariant under changes of coordinates over my parameter space. Invariant under diffeomorphisms, and so on and so forth. Not this reference matrix. But this is a pretty ugly expression. Well, let's say that it's reasonable to now look for some very
convenient parametrization of this reference matrix. Actually, these are the reference matrix, remember? I call them probably twiddle. So that this becomes as simple as possible. Yes?
What are these operators that we use?
Yes. Yes. So these are operators made out of matter fields. For tachyons, these are just going to be e to the I, p1x, and so on. Is this clear? This expression familiar? Any questions? Okay. Now, how do we describe something like that? First of all, notice that essentially, you know, we're going to want to have B and B bar insertions. And so if I start with some matrix, the Z bar, okay, and I want to do a small change into this matrix, which I cannot undo by a conformal transformation, essentially what I need to do is to add to it something like this. Probably like that, actually. I want something. So I want okay, one of them is being written in the other beta bar, I forget which one. Anyway, the reason the moduli space is a complex manifold is essentially that locally, some deformation, I can say that these are holomorphic deformations of the matrix, and these are anti-holomorphic deformations of the matrix. Okay? Now, so these expressions like that become something like B delta beta over delta mu, or B bar delta beta bar over delta mu bar. Okay.
That's what makes it the BABGH.
That's right. That's right. So there is a variation of the of the HZZ component of the metric, which comes together with B, and the variation of the HZ bar that comes together with B bar. And then I can continue and try to find some useful choice of beta. Okay. For example, I could say, okay, I want to keep these 3 points fixed and only move the fourth one a little bit to the side. That means I'll pick I sort of try to change the metric near this point so that that when I go back to flat coordinate, to a flat metric, the point will get moved a little. Okay, so roughly I can use some delta betas and some changes in the metric which are localized around this point. And doing it carefully, I can get to a pretty simple final expression. Where mu is just parametrized by the moduli space is just parametrized by the position of this fourth point. So my integral becomes an integral over Z4 bar. And then the effect of this B and B bar insertions localized close the fourth puncture is pretty much just the same as removing C and C bar from here. So this is usually the final expression, what's almost taken as a, I mean, Alternatively, you could just say, okay, I take this as definition and I check it makes sense. Why does this make sense? Well, this makes sense for a variety of reasons. First of all, this object has conformal dimension 1, which means it transforms as a one form. It transforms by the Jacobian of both del z over del z prime and del z bar over del z bar prime. Its dimension has delta equal to 1 and delta bar equal to 1, which means it makes sense to multiply it by dz4 and dz4 bar. If I change, see, this is something nice to integrate over z4 and z4 bar. Furthermore, you could ask what happens if I act with q on this. And you can show that if you act with q on this, you essentially get something like c del z4 v4 plus complex conjugate. Sorry, I think this is inside. Which means that if I act with q on this, I get a total derivative. So this is not quite q closed, this is before, but it's pretty close. If I act with q on it, I get a total derivative that then integrates to zero.
These are the vertex
that's right, for the matter fields. No, these are, no, this comes from something on, this is on shell, right? This total of the conformal dimension was zero, which means that this one has conformal dimension one on holomorphic and anti-holomorphic sides. So I could have just said, I could have just started from this and said, okay, look, I don't want to do this calculation. I'm just going to get rid of the Siegels by hand and check if it makes sense. Or you can try to do the calculation. But the calculation is actually not that hard. Essentially, the trick is that you're using a beta. Is to use a beta, which is a delta function, sort of a delta function. So you can imagine that your beta really lives, you have changed the metric only by a delta function around your point. So that when you try to eliminate this by change of coordinates, the change of coordinates essentially ends up just taking this patch and moving it. And so the result is that this becomes sort of a contour integral of B around this. Okay, contour integral of B essentially is something like this, is a Fourier mode of B. And it's precisely B minus one, which ends up removing C. So the, in other words, the long way to do this calculation is to say, okay, I changed my metric in a smart way. I reduced this double integral to a contour integral. And then I check that contour integral removes the C. Alternatively, you just check that this makes sense. And it makes sense because although this is not BSD closed, it's closed up to total derivative, which means essentially this guy altogether is Q closed. As long as your total derivative integrates to zero. Now you might worry here, and you should. What if my total derivative does not integrate to zero? What if I get some boundary terms? And the sort of boundary terms can occur. They have to do with infrared effects. They occur in all the situations where in quantum field theory you will have some infrared effects that forces you to combine this diagram with some other loop diagram to get something finite. Remember in quantum field theory, when you have, you know, scattering amplitudes, or you can emit a soft photon, you might get in trouble. And this combines with contributions on diagrams like this. So string theory at low energy reduces to quantum field theory. So it has all this, it's subject to all this, all sort of technicalities which quantum field theory is subject to in the infrared. So I'm not going to deal with these issues, but just put an alert. Sometimes you might find some subtleties. These subtleties are never worse than what you would have in quantum field theory in a similar situation. Okay. So anyway, so this is as much as I am willing to do to justify this expression. Now let's do some calculations with it. I'll try to put some more details about this in the note. It's not there yet, but it should be there by next weekend, by next week. Also, of course, all of these things are discussed in Polchinski in the text. Okay. So, how do you compute that? We take the correlation function of the ghosts, we take the correlation function of the matter fields. The correlation function of the matter fields is very simple. And the one of the ghosts we saw yesterday. So, the correlation function between the boson, free boson vertex operators, give me this sort of factors for exponentiating ring functions, which I've seen yesterday. And then there is a contribution from the C ghosts. And then so you see, this comes from weak contractions between V4 and VI. This comes from weak contraction between VI and VJ. And I'm integrating over the position of the fourth coordinate. Now, does this make sense? Let's see. For example, this integral can possibly make sense only if this is not too divergent. Okay. At least as it is written. Now, also, so we need to check the convergence near these punctures and at infinity. Now, if at infinity, this behaves P4 times some of the PIs, this is a tachyon, so overall it behaves like absolute value to the minus of Z4 to the minus 4 as Z4 goes to infinity. So this is fine. When you approach other punctures, it becomes a little more subtle because it converges only if this is the case. Right? If this exponent is smaller than minus 2, you're going to get in trouble when you try to do this integral. Because near the puncture, if I call the distance on the puncture r, this behaves like r dr times r to this power. But this constraint is actually something we see also in quantum field theory. I mean, in quantum field theory, we were studying the sort of scattering amplitude. There was a propagator, say that this is P1 and this was P4. There was a propagator like 1 over P1 plus P4 square plus M squared, right? And we rewrote it as integral of e to the minus tau P1 plus P4 squared plus M squared. Now, rewriting it like this, strictly speaking, is only valid if this exponent is negative. Okay. If this exponent is not negative, we need to either rotate the weak this integration contour, or to do the calculation where this is negative and then analytically continue. This expression is completely analogous to this sort of expression in quantum field theory. Okay. Essentially, the distance from Z4 to a puncture behaves like e to the minus tau over there. So there are two ways to deal with this here too. We can either say we go to a kinematic region where all of these satisfy this constraint, and then analytically continue. This is how usually it's explained in the textbooks. Or you can try to analytically continue the integration contour. Perhaps a way to think about this physically is also that we're working with Euclidean worksheets. They are embedded in space-time. And the places where you start encountering trouble here are the places pretty much in which intermediate particles start going on shell. So you know that your entity is going to have poles when the intermediate legs go on shell. The first of these poles is encountered where this condition fails, because this integral starts diverging. To go beyond that pole, you either analytically continue around it, or you try to deal with it in a slightly different way, which is, as I was saying, kind of integration, deforming integration contour. The way it happens is that you can think about this as a contour integral in the Z4 and the Z4 bar on a contour where Z4 equal to Z4 bar conjugate. Okay. The integrand is the product of something holomorphic and something anthropomorphic. So you can sort of imagine moving away from this locus and deforming it a bit. This would allow you to make sense of this integral even for generic value of this. This treatment is discussed in a paper from a year or two ago of Witten. And it's useful if you want to really understand things like I epsilon prescriptions. Anyway, let's just do the integral where we can do it, and it will be a nice analytic function of the momenta, and then we can analytically continue it. Perhaps I should really stress this integral really behaves very much like the quantum field theory expression. But somehow it has all the divergences and properties simultaneously of a diagram like this, or a diagram like this, or a diagram like this. So this integral is trying to do the job of quantum field theory S, T, and U channels with all possible intermediate states. And you can imagine literally taking this integrand and say expand it in power of Z4 minus Z1, okay? Writing Z4 minus Z1 as sort of e to the minus tau. And then this integrand, at least for Z4 close to Z1, will look like this. I mean, each term in this power series will look like this. Now, how do we do this integral? Well, first of all, notice this is supposed to be gauge invariant. It's supposed to be independent of Z1, Z2, Z3. This can be made manifest by change of coordinates. of this sort. If you do this change of coordinate inside this integral, it becomes much simpler. Essentially, this transformation has put the z1, z2, z3 points to t equal to 0, 1, and infinity. So now you can see the divergences, the possible divergences, at t goes to 0, 1, or infinity. So this equality only holds if things are on shell. Okay, so in going from here to here, I used p1 squared equal to p2 squared equal to p3 squared equal to p4 squared equal to 2. Otherwise, I would have obtained in front some big complicated fat product of these. Now, how do we do this integral? It's actually not an integral that you find easily in tables. There are a variety of ways you can do this. For example, you could imagine writing each of these as some auxiliary integral, something like a Feynman parametrization. There is a neat way to think about this, which is to use this trick of treating t and t bar as independent variables. So writing it as an integral, a contour integral over the t bar, over some contour where t star equal to t bar of the holomorphic thing. An anti-holomorphic thing. And the trick is to realize that in an appropriate sense, this contour integral can be deformed without changing the answer. Can be deformed to contours, which are actually a product of a contour for t and a different contour for t bar. Each of these individual integrals for t and t bar is something called beta integral. It gives you a product of gamma functions. So as long as you know how to do these manipulations of contours, the calculation becomes straightforward. But let me just give the final answer. It's called the Virasoro-Shapiro amplitude. I invite you to try to do this integral in another way that you like. So, a whole bunch of gamma functions. All these gamma functions have poles. Now, where do they have poles? So, they have poles where this argument becomes zero or negative. So this is poles whenever before dot pi equals minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, etc. Or 2 before dot pi is minus 2, minus 4, minus 6. Or before plus pi squared equals to 2, 0, minus 2, minus 4, minus 6, and so on. Now you should recognize these as the masses of string states. So you see these are exactly the poles that correspond to intermediate propagating strings going on shell. This amplitude has all the poles that it should and nothing else to be interpreted in the quantum field theory amplitude. But magically, the same expression manages to have poles in all three channels. In a sense, this amplitude or a similar amplitude for open strings was kind of the beginning of string theory. People were trying to find, at some point, people were trying to sort of bootstrap S matrices, trying to write down interesting S matrices. And they stumbled into expressions like this. We can actually try to compute the residues of these poles. So suppose, for example, that we want to study the poles at P4 dot P1 equal to minus n. Okay, so we plug this into that amplitude. So first of all, the gamma function of, so this gamma function is what's going to give you the pole. If you remember, the poles of gamma function are roughly n factorial over epsilon, I think. There might be an n plus 1 here, I don't remember. Check me out. But so this factorial cancels against this. So the role of this gamma denominator is just to make sure that the poles of the gamma denominator don't blow up too much. Right. And then we can use the momentum conservation to rewrite the denominators in an interesting way. Now you can use the definition of gamma function to telescope this, taking a ratio of gamma functions whose arguments differ by integral bounds. You get something like this. Now what I want to observe is that these numerators, the residue of these poles is a big polynomial. This makes sense because we know that the strings that we are scattering, that we are exchanging, have arbitrarily high spin. Remember those string states we were putting at the blackboard had a lot of Lorentz indices, which means that the interaction vertices over here end up having a lot of momenta, right? The amplitude for two tachyons to produce a string with k Lorentz indices will have k powers of the momentum. And then there will be another k powers of the momentum in this interaction vertex here. So this is how you can understand all of these powers of the momenta. So, you know, morally speaking, you can say, okay, I can take this amplitude, just write it as a sum over residues. Sum over these coefficients times 1 over P4 times P1 minus n plus n. Okay. But then the coefficients of the sum will grow very fast. So each individual term behaves very badly, has very a lot of powers to the momenta, grows very high with energy. But together they conspire to give something which is actually much better behaved at high energy. So here there is a concrete manifestation of the words that I was saying last week. Scattering amplitudes behave like quantum field theory scattering amplitudes with low energy, with an infinite tower of particles. But at high energy, all this tower of particles conspire to give some different behavior. So for example, if you write things in terms of the Mandelstam variables, then say we look at the, okay, we can write that expression just in terms of the Mandelstam variables. It's pretty easy, but let me just do it because it's conventional. So if I want to really check what the behavior is, if I really want to see the strings rather than the particles, I can look at processes where the energy of the overall the energy in all the channels is going to infinity, where say U, S, and T are sent to infinity, keeping the ratios fixed. Okay, this means I'm just taking the strings and scattering against each other a very high momentum and see what comes out in very different directions. And the amplitude in this is S and T go to, and U go to infinity, behaves as e to the minus S log S minus T log T minus U log U. So this is something you can find just by looking using a Stirling approximation on the gamma functions, the standard asymptotics of factorials. So you see, these strings are really fluffy. If you send them against each other very hard, they just pass across each other. They don't even see each other. The amplitude goes down exponentially fast at high energy. It's radically different from quantum field theory scattering amplitude, which goes like 1 over some power of S if it's a well-behaved scattering amplitude. And, you know, we could continue doing calculations like these for other particles. You have all the tools that are required to do that. For example, suppose you wanted to study the scattering of 2 gravitons in 2 gravitons. You could. You would need to change the vertex operators a little bit. You would get some extra powers, some extra rational functions of the Z's in front of this integral, but ultimately it would reduce to some combinatorics, some, you know, contracting momenta in various ways, and adding up a bunch of integrals like this. S log S, T log T, U log U. So still, this would be a rather tedious way to discover that there are really that gravity is hiding here. Right? You might wonder, is there a more effective way to figure out if this is really a theory of gravity plus other things? And in principle, if somebody gives you the scattering amplitudes, you can step by step reconstruct from them an effective action. Sort of walk backwards. Try to break down each process in individual interaction vertices and try to write down an effective action. But it's a bit painful. And yeah, it's natural to ask if there is a better way. And there is. It's a sort of a circuitous way that then end up in the right place. So this will be mostly the subject of next week lectures. But I was thinking that perhaps it's worth sketching what we are going to do. But first, I would like to make sure that you have no more questions about this. In a sense, I mean, it's a calculation. So most of the interesting points come out in observing and staring at the answer for a while. And admittedly, it's not a, you know, just looking at it is, yes.
I've got a question. You said that these higher polynomials of the momentum correspond to higher spins of the intermediate spin.
Yes.
How's this notion of spins connected to like some representation, I guess you could say? Is it the same notion of spins?
Well, with spin, I mean representations of the little group, which I guess is SOD minus one. So here we're in 26 dimensions. So the massive string modes, for example, would be organized in representations of SO 25. You can discuss what are the reducible representations of SO 25, but pretty much it's just, you can think about them as tensors with a bunch of indices, which can be symmetric or anti-symmetric, symmetrized or anti-symmetrized in various ways, because you have a metric contracted. So, you know, if you look at, so for example, right, if you remember at level 2, when we're looking at states of mass 2, p squared equal to minus 2, we had all this sort of stuff. These are states with four indices. I could perhaps call them spin 4. In a somewhat loose way. But really, I should be more careful and decompose them into a variety of representations of the Lorentz group, or the Poincaré group. So for example, I could take all these indices, symmetrize them all, take away all traces. This would be one representation. Or I could say, okay, these two indices are already symmetric, so I cannot do much about it, but I can anti-symmetrize these two and these two. That would give me something that would resemble a bit a Riemann tensor in terms of index factor. And so on. Okay. So what we're going to do next lecture is going to be to sort of, next week is going to be to switch gear a little. Here we're discussing strings in flat space and looking at the modes of those strings. Next week we'll start asking the question, okay, what if the strings are not moving in flat space? After all, we can write the action of the strings in a generic background. What if I want a string moving in a non-trivial metric? called the ground metric. And then we will, that will allow us to sort of figure out which matrix can a string move in. We'll find that the string can only move in matrices that satisfy some equations of motion. And then we'll figure out why is that and relate the fluctuations of the matrix or whatever other background we picked to the string modes and their scattering amplitudes. So we'll get to the sort of the effective action for the strings from a very from an indirect root, and then argue that it must match what you get from scattering amplitudes. That will be probably one or two lectures. Then we'll discuss D-brains, finally, into these open strings. And then towards the end, I will try to give a sketch of how superstring perturbation theory works, how to describe strings which have fermions too, not just bosons. But this is more or less the plan for next week. If you have any questions about this week, I can stop 5 minutes early, so you can ask me any questions you want. And then on Monday too, before we start, feel free to ask any questions about this past week.